This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Our portrait of this war has not been painted solely by the usual complement of reporters, pundits, and politicians. A wide range of new voices has emerged to add context, detail, and dimension to the picture. Chief among these new voices, the hugely influential, in some quarters infamous, satellite news channel Al Jazeera.
Launched 12 years ago by the emir of Qatar with the goal of being an independent voice in the region, Al Jazeera has at one time or other been booted out of most of the Middle Eastern nations it covers. The White House, too, condemns it as hateful propaganda, citing its repeated airings of Osama bin Laden tapes and continuous grisly footage of the war. Al Jazeera's offices were bombed by the U.S. military in Afghanistan in 2001 and in Baghdad in 2003. Brigadier General Vincent K. Brooks said that reporters were not targeted, but that the battlefield was, quote, a dangerous place.
And a hard place to win hearts and minds, but Al Jazeera has won them. As of 2007, its Arabic channel rivaled the BBC with roughly 40 to 50 million viewers worldwide. But hearts and minds are not so easily won here. After Al Jazeera's English-language website was hacked in 2003, I asked the site's managing editor, Joanne Tucker, how she justified what seemed to be a pattern of anti-American war coverage, civilian casualties dominating every headline.
It strikes me that Al Jazeera has a special responsibility to play it straight down the middle and not to reflect back the worldview of its audience.
But we're not just looking at ourselves and reflecting what we see in the mirror. If you honestly and intelligently reflect the opinions and the facts and the views of this part of the world, how can it be skewing the news any more than reflecting the West's views and opinions skews the news for Western watchers? I keep hearing about this holy grail of objectivity and neutrality. I certainly don't see it on American television. So, you know, how they can apply these standards to us all the time, I don't know. But we try and report probing taboos, crossing red lines as often as we can. Does this get us in hot water all the time? But I think this is a price worth paying.
That price climbs higher the closer you get to events on the ground. And that brings us to the amateur scribes, Iraqi citizens and American soldiers. The soldier blogs are direct descendants of letters from the battlefield, only now they're available to all in real time.
You know, I don't comment on army policy. I try not to comment on politics.
We reached Colonel and blogger Michael Bautista in Kirkuk in 2005. He said he started his blog to chronicle his personal experience, but over time, he used it to convey what he believed was the real story of the war, not just car bombings and death, but mission and accomplishment.
I want to say to the American public that my brothers and sisters in arms that have died in this conflict have not died in vain. This is a just cause, and that it's a righteous endeavor. That's part of why I write. If I'm given an opportunity to say it, by God, I will.
What about your personal feelings? Do you ever, for instance, get afraid? And do you write about that fear?
I'm sure that my enemy probably reads my blog. One of the things that I need to make sure is that I don't tell him that I'm scared of him. I mean, hey, every day I go out into a foreign city where there are a number of people who don't want me there, and they possess explosives and guns, and of course there's fear every time you leave the wire, and even just walking around inside the wire. You cannot communicate that to your enemy, or else you will lose.
Soldier blogger Jason Hartley, who had spent 14 years in the National Guard, used his blog to explore the absurdities of life in wartime, and it cost him a promotion and a hefty fine. You were accused at one point of conduct unbecoming a non-commissioned officer because
Yes.
you took a picture of yourself sitting on the can.
Yes.
You said that you think Army leadership can't grasp that it's possible for a soldier to be critical or satirical of the Army and still be pro-Army.
This bothers me a lot. My commander, he assumes that I don't like the army. It's not the case. I love the army, and my way of exalting it is like, here's some pretty absurd stuff we did today. Is what happened. Doesn't mean I love the army any less. It's just something kind of funny we did.
Did you learn anything about yourself writing about yourself?
Yes. I didn't really intend to always write about duality, but that was always what I found was this common thread for the most part. An event would take place, and there would always be these incredibly opposing ideas. Even with things that I felt sometimes, the first time that I actually shot at someone with the intent to kill them, intellectually, I know this is morally repugnant. There's no more bigger than the murder of another human being. But that experience, that was the most exhilarating thing that I've ever experienced in my life, was making concerted effort to kill someone. I have to admit this.
Friday, December 26, 2003, 1:07 a.m.
Blogs are personal.
Tonight, the Daily Thuds started a bit earlier. It was around 10, and NBC2 was showing Sleepless in Seattle. I'm a bit embarrassed to say this, but I am a sucker for a Meg Ryan movie. The only problem was the sound of the explosions was a bit too close.
That entry, read by someone on our staff, comes from the blog Where is Raid, written by the once mysterious Iraqi blogger Salam Pax.
It wasn't just the thud we got used to in the last 2 days, but a very deep rumble as well. It's the third night now. Can anyone please tell me what's going on?
In the spring of 2003, his blog disappeared for a few weeks, and people on several continents who hung on his idiosyncratic dispatches from Iraq were gripped with fear. Iraqi blogs offered a way out of the soda straw created by the embed system. They couldn't be fact-checked, but the people who wrote them were palpably real.
Wednesday, January 28th, 2004, 12:50 a.m., I've been tuning into the American Forces Network much more often than the radio we Iraqis are supposed to be listening to. They played Rage Against the Machine's Testify. Baghdad is burning. That cunning mantra of killing. I need you, my witness, to dress this up so bloodless, to numb me and purge me now of thoughts of blaming you. It is a bit scary to have a military radio that plays this song here in Baghdad.
Turns out, Salam Pax was the nom de plume of Salam al-Janabi, a fixer for an American reporter in Iraq. Once, Western reporters could travel freely, but now they increasingly rely on Iraqi bloggers to keep them up to speed and Iraqi fixers to bring the reporting to them. What follows is a story I reported in 2006 about Iraqis pulled into journalism by a trick of fate, caught up in the wave of correspondence pouring in from the West. George Packer, author of The Assassin's Gate, found the blog called Healing Iraq while covering Iraq for The New Yorker.
Well, the first time you go to his blog, it says something like, views of an Iraqi dentist. And then there's a quote, I believe, from Swift. So you're just thinking an Iraqi dentist whose epigraph on his blog is from Jonathan Swift and who is writing these long, informed, historical accounts of what's going on in Iraq today. Who is this guy? Where did he learn all this? You know, why is he writing this? Is he real?
It is useless to attempt to reason a man out of what he was never reasoned into. That's the epigraph from Swift that sits atop Healing Iraq.
I thought he was maybe 50. Not a guy in his mid to late 20s, because he seemed so reflective and sort of sad and slightly disdainful about the militias and about the violence and about Iraqi politicians and about American mistakes. But there was no hysteria and there was no rank partisanship. He somehow seemed to take the whole thing in and see it as the tragedy that it was and is.
I thought that in the early days of the war, the Western media was just pouring into Iraq and they were confused about everything and they were just missing a local perspective.
Ziad, he prefers to leave off his last name, writes Healing Iraq.
There were many misconceptions in the Western press, too many to count. So I just tried to do one at a time and that I thought that would be my mission. I was probably one of the few people who actually supported the war, at least in my community in Baghdad. I wanted to convey that sense and that support.
Ziad is now studying journalism at the City University of New York, reporting on local stories in Brooklyn. On Monday, he posted this on Healing Iraq.
Another close friend of mine has been killed in Baghdad. We had lunch together in Baghdad just days before I left. I can't concentrate on anything anymore. I should not be here in New York, running around a stupid neighborhood asking people about their issues. I now officially regret supporting this war back in 2003. The guilt is too much for me to handle.
Do you feel like you've marooned yourself onto a desert island or something?
Yes, sometimes I have that feeling. I get depressed many times and think, what am I doing here? I mean, I should be back with my family. I mean, if they're in danger, at least I should be in danger with them. I can't be safe here while they're suffering over there. I'm also willing to learn. That's what I came here for. That's at least what I tell myself.
Ziad doesn't see himself as a newspaper or TV reporter. He doesn't want to work for a Western news agency. He's not even ready to renounce dentistry. But for now, he says he needs to reach out to the West his way.
Maybe my focus on online journalism is kind of my way out of this. not to be immersed too much in the risks and at the same time doing my best to get out the story. I mean, that's what I can do. I mean, I can't be like any of those brave Iraqi springers who went to Fallujah and embedded with insurgents. I could never do that.
Ali Fadil does that. A doctor who ran afoul of Saddam's regime when he bought a color laser printer without permission, he fled and was practicing medicine in Yemen. When Baghdad fell, he returned.
To participate in building my country, and I thought, we have now a new Iraq, we'll have the best Iraq ever in the world. I have to be there from the beginning.
But in the Baghdad hospital where he worked, the equipment didn't work. The security was non-existent.
And worse than that, politics was coming into the hospitals. It was coming into the Minister of Health. You can see everything is being taken from you and like you're an alien in your country. At that time, I was approached by the media, by the Financial Times. I thought, okay, I couldn't do anything as a doctor. Probably I can do something as a journalist.
Did it ever occur to you before this point that this might be a profession you'd want to be in, journalism?
No, not at all. No, never.
In reporter speak, a fixer is a translator, navigator, and person finder for a journalist on unfamiliar ground. But in Iraq, where the streets are perilous, the fixer often is the unsung reporter who asks the questions and brings the answers back to his journalist boss. A great fixer can even save your life. One reporter described Ali Fadil as a rock star among fixers, smuggling one Western reporter under a blanket in a free fire zone, clearing the path for another who wanted to speak with some angry young man with guns. Now, Ali works as a freelancer because working with Western reporters is more likely to get you killed. But even alone, it's still likely. George Packer.
They're targeted by the Sunni insurgents. If they write bad things about the Shiite militias, they're targeted by them. They often run afoul of the American military at checkpoints or simply by being in Baghdad and being Iraqi. And now more and more, the Iraqi government is their main enemy because it's clamping down on them, it's throwing them in jail, it's beating them up, it's keeping them from the news.
Last month, Ali Fadil wrote a piece in the New York Times praising the efforts of the Coalition Provisional Authority to establish a free press in Iraq.
Ali wrote that it would be very ironic if the Americans, having sort of fathered this democratic process and created an independent Iraqi press, watched while it turned into yet another state-controlled press corps like in every neighboring country. I would say, though, that unlike the Iraqi police and army, the young Iraqi journalists I know are real professionals and are quickly achieving sort of international standards of excellence and are winning awards and are keeping the world informed and are getting killed for it.
So I put it to Ali, currently studying journalism at New York University. This is a really dangerous job. You have a wife and two kids. How come you want to do it?
I want to correct this. I have an angry wife and two kids. She's very angry about my job. She hates that I'm doing this job. The reason why I'd like journalism, the reason why I thought that the risk you take while doing a story is worth it is because I saw Western journalists throwing themselves in these remote areas of Iraq. I've never dreamed of going to these areas, and I think it's too dangerous just to be there as a human being, but they just go for the sake of the story. I worship this thing in journalism, and that's the way how it goes, and I think that's the way I'm going to take it. It's my country at the end, and I have access to many places in Iraq Westerners don't have.
Unlike Ali, Ayub Nouri did not become a journalist by accident. Born in the Kurdish town of Halabja, notoriously gassed by Saddam, he was a teenager when he met his first Western journalists, a British TV crew, who hired him as a translator. He was already an experienced reporter at the age of 24 when Elizabeth Rubin, filing for the New Republic just before the war, hired him as a fixer for a trip to an Arab part of Kurdistan.
And the Kurds were telling us, don't go, you're going to be killed. And Ayub basically said to me, though he is a Kurd, he said, don't trust these guys. They've been looting every single Arab village and they don't want us to see it. And so we went to this village and, in fact, there was a fight going on between the Kurds and the Arabs of this village because the Kurds were trying to steal all the petrol at this gas station. And in fact, that's exactly what they hadn't wanted us to see. And so we went and were with this Arab family, found out everything that was going on. And people trusted him because they saw that he was also not playing on any tribal card. You know, he was looking for the truth.
Everything goes back to not being free.
Ayub Nouri never believed he could be a journalist in Iraq because the media weren't free. But he always knew how it could sound because it poured out of his father's radio.
He was listening to the Persian and Arabic service of the BBC when I was a child, every morning, every night. And then I bought my own radio and listened to the BBC all day long. And I think that's how I learned my English, from listening to the BBC. I was jealous of the reporters when they were reading their sign-off saying so-and-so from Kuala Lumpur, for example. That was my only dream, one day to be a reporter and say that.
For the world, I am Ayub Nouri, Baghdad.
We're talking to Ayub Nouri, who reports for the BBC. He's been telling me
for the world, this is Ayub Nouri, Kut, southern Iraq.
Ayub is also in New York at the moment, studying at Columbia Journalism School. But like Ziad, like Ali, Ayub is planning to head back. As the death toll mounts and the despair deepens in Iraq, these and many other Iraqi journalists are ready to stand up, even as Western journalists are forced to stand down. We spoke to Ziad, Ali, and Ayub in the fall of 2006. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 177 journalists and support staff have died in the service of reporting this war. 154 of them were Iraqis.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Andy Lancet, Kevin Lahoda, Nadia Zonis, and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On our site, onthemedia.org, you can find highlights of OTM's coverage of the war and a timeline of media milestones. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.